Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. And it's a motorsport-themed podcast this week. We promised you last week that we would make use of all that preparation Andrew had done for the topic motor racing dynasties, although he's now just told me that he can no longer read his own handwriting. So who knows how well this one will go. And we've got a couple of other things to cover before we get stuck into that, though, Andrew. And we're recording this on a Monday morning rather than our usual slot on the Friday, which means we can talk about the Monaco Grand Prix. Although, should we?
Yeah, I think we probably should, actually. I mean, the Monaco Grand Prix weekend, at least, I still, regardless of the, okay, the race was a processional bore. But there are things to talk about even there, particularly, you know, why Mercedes didn't, you know, shine. But I just enjoy watching cars being driven, if not necessarily raced around Monaco. You know, I've said this before, but there is just nowhere where you can see more easily the skill of these drivers. You know, Max's average race speed was almost 100 miles an hour. Yeah. Now, if you think about all the times you got caught in traffic and everything else, but, you know, you are talking about Formula One cars, I've got to the stage now where they can lap that circuit at 100 miles an hour. And anybody listening to this who's ever gone down there and done a lap in the traffic, like I think most of us have, will understand how insane that is. And to watch them, particularly as they're sort of, as they come out of Tabac and places like that, and they are, you know, at times it's not inches, it's millimeters from the barriers. And just to see the sheer skill, it's a much more cerebral experience, I guess. It's not sort of like, wait, hey, look how sideways they're going or anything like that. But if you really are interested in driving, just as an art, I still think that the spectacle of seeing a top driver racing a car that fast around a circuit that unsuited to such car is a thing of wonder, really. And, you know, and the race was dull, sadly. But at the same time, you know, this is the race in which, for the first time this season, you know, I don't know when a Red Bull last led the championship, well, both championships, but they do now. They've got another street circuit to come up in Baku in a couple of weeks' time. So I guess the question is, has the tide turned? I know what my answer to that question is, but what do you think?
I think it's absolutely not turned.
No, so do I.
I think what we've seen is a circuit that highlights the virtues and deficiencies of two quite different cars. The Mercedes, quite apart from that awful pit stop that he never drove away from for Valtteri Bottas, they had a
I had a premonition
weekend.
About that.
Did you? Why didn't
I
you
did.
Tell us?
No, well, because I had a premonition about it as he was coming down the pit lane.
Oh, okay.
It was only like 5-second premonition, but I'm not sort of into all that sort of weird spooky stuff at all. I really am not. But all I can tell you is I was absolutely sitting there and he was coming down the pit lane and I just thought to myself, he's going to have a real problem here.
Really?
And I was right. Yeah, it was very strange. It was very, very strange. Well, but you wouldn't expect it to, would you? But I literally was thinking, something's not going to go right here. I didn't realise just how wrong it was going to go, but I thought he was going to have a terrible pit stop. But anyway, yes, sorry, you were saying.
Well, yeah, I mean, quite apart from that terrible pit stop, and it's, oh my God, do you know what? Forget all the millions that have been spent developing that car. The Mercedes' enormous investment, and it comes down to a wheel nut. Just astonishing. But I feel for Bottas because he clearly wasn't particularly happy with that car. He was happier than Lewis, I would imagine. But he didn't seem to be having, you know, the easiest run all weekend. And so he's hustling this thing around there. He actually is risking his life around there because they're coming out of the tunnel, they're getting close to 200 miles an hour. You know, it is a fundamentally dangerous thing to do. And all of that comes down to a bloody wheel nut that refuses to come off, that threads it. It's just, it must be utterly gutting. Imagine that, how hyped you are, how filled with adrenaline you are in that moment. And then you just crash. It must be an incredibly difficult thing to deal with. I think what we saw was, I've read up a bit about it actually, and basically the Mercedes car is just not well suited to a circuit like that, where a low energy circuit, so they're not switching on their tyres, and so what they have to do is go quite aggressive with, well, I don't know what, but the setup, so maybe that's Geo or something, just to try and switch the tyres on. And of course that means that you just ruin them through the race, and you get terrible tyre wear, and that's what was happening to Bottas. That's why he couldn't hold on to Max. So the car just doesn't work there.
And that's why, presumably, Lewis was first to pit out of everybody.
Yeah. Well, it could well be. It looked like they made some bad strategy calls, but they're dealing with a car that just doesn't like being raced around there. The flip side is that it works better on high energy circuits. And so the moment we get to a Silverstone or a Spa, it's just the Mercs are just going to be back in front, and those Ferraris are going to slip back again.
Yeah, probably. No, absolutely. No, I think that's absolutely right. What did you make of Lewis getting on the blower and being really very critical of the team? And that's it. You know, there are two ways of looking at it. You know, part of you could think, well, that's, you know, the petulant old Lewis that we've seen too much in the past. And then there's another part which thinks, well, actually, maybe, you know, they expect so much of themselves. That when they slip up as they do, it really needs to be called out. And in those sorts of times, I don't know where I am with that, but I was surprised because, you know, we haven't heard Lewis talking like that on the radio for a long time now. And I was a bit taken aback, but actually then I thought, yeah, if your standards are that high and you find yourself, you know, down in seventh with three people you should be ahead of, now ahead of you, I can understand why he might have been a little bit put out by it.
Yeah, well, I think that he knows he's in a title fight this year, and he's not going to romp to, well, maybe he will, but he probably thinks he's not going to romp to the title like he has done the last couple of years, and that every point really counts. And so there's a weight of, there's a pressure there. I also think, what's great about Team Radio is that drivers forget it's actually a public forum. And so that's where you get their honest views, because in all his social media output and interviews after the race, he's gracious and he's not calling out the team. He was actually a little bit more than we have seen him do in the past. He was clearly frustrated. But ultimately, after the weekend, he was saying, we win and lose together. We will learn from this. We will come back stronger. So I don't think he's trying to call out the team. I don't think he's trying to create issues there. But in the heat of the moment over the radio, you get their honest opinion. And he was clearly livid with them. He thinks, from his point of view, from his perspective in that moment, clearly, he thinks they made...
A stack of points, certainly. What do we make of it? Seems ridiculous to be talking about someone who's won the Monaco Grand Prix three times, but it is a bit of a bogey circuit for Lewis, isn't it? You know, you think that, you know, that there are, you know, there are lots of people out there who, well, not lots of people, there are some people who've won it, you know, 5-6 times, and Lewis, despite having been a Grand Prix, this is now I think his 15th season, he's only won it three times. Whereas at some other circuits, he's kind of like a sort of serial winner. It's sort of more, it's rarer when he doesn't win than when he does. And I don't know whether it's just bad luck or whether it's something about his driving style, or maybe he's just been in cars, because he's only ever driven for two manufacturers. And maybe he's just only ever been in cars which happen not to work around circuits like that.
I think that's right. I think the Mercedes actually hasn't been well suited. It's a long wheelbase car, isn't it? It doesn't have the... we think it doesn't have the downforce of the Red Bull. And actually, for the last few years, whereas Red Bull has been competitive on the engine side, that has been the fastest car around there. The Red Bull has been the gun car. We've seen Ricciardo's won it. I think that has been the car to have. And so how many opportunities has Lewis actually had to win it? There have been a couple of incidents that have denied him a win. He could quite easily have won it four or five times, and then we wouldn't be having this discussion. But it's an interesting anomaly, and it's a bizarre thing to say about someone. He's only won it three times.
Particularly at the circuit where, traditionally, people have thought, as we said in this podcast, it's where the skill shines most brightly. And there's any question that Lewis is the most skilled driver out there. So you'd think he would be most at home, but he's not. I think it's got everything to do with the cars. And I think also the reason, therefore, that I don't think it is going to be, I'm afraid, a sort of last race thriller of a title fight, because what Mercedes does is they create a car which works best on most circuits, and Monaco is an anomaly. And I think as the season progresses, as we get to faster circuits, as we get to the Spas and the Silverstones and the Monzas and so on and so forth, I think Red Bull will be closer this year, but I can't see it coming down to a title decider in the last race. I can't myself, but I hope I'm wrong.
I think I agree with you. I think we and others in the media have played up this title battle a little bit.
I agree.
And I think that narrative has been sort of supported until now, but I think the reality is that it's not as close as it looks. If you look at Spain, which is probably more representative of a typical circuit, the Mercedes actually monstered Red Bull there. The way Hamilton came through with a good number of laps still to go and got past Max, there was no defending that, and there was no way Max was going to win that race. So I think that is actually a truer reflection of what we're going to see for the rest of the year.
It is. I mean, because that circuit is meant to be the sort of, the archetypal Formula One circuit, isn't it? It's the kind of the default, it's the baseline setting for, and all other circuits are sort of, a bit different to that. But that's kind of like the midpoint, isn't it? And you're absolutely right. Around there, no one's going to get near them, or any circuit like it.
Yeah, we'll have to reflect on this a few months from now. We'll see how wrong we were. Because let's just remember that we did predictions, didn't we, before the start of the weekend. And you said Hamilton, Poland win. on reflection. I mean, maybe... Yeah,
what,
maybe
did, you, what did you say? You said Max, Poland win, didn't you?
I think I said Max, but I actually... Only to be different,
Well, you're assumed, only half wrong.
Yeah, well, there we go. I assumed... I did think Lewis would do it, but clearly... The car just wasn't working there.
No.
A moment about Leclerc. Great to get pole there. I don't think he did it on purpose, putting it in the wall.
Of course he didn't do it on purpose.
No.
I never thought that. I mean, no. Sorry. that's a big accident to go and have, given the speed you're doing. No one is going to go and have, a really big accident. Because, he could so, if you think of what Nico did or what Michael did, they made that happen. No, forget it. And also, I don't know the bloke, I've never met him, but from seeing that, I just don't think he's that sort of person. I just don't think he's got that Machiavellian streak in him. Maybe that's being terribly naive, but no, I absolutely don't believe for a second that was some devilish ploy to go and have a really bad accident. And also, Ferrari have now said they don't think it was... the accident which put the car out before the start of the race. But, you're going to have an accident like that. You're going to whack the car quite hard. Are you really going to risk, at best, a five-place grid drop trying to secure a pole by driving into a wall that high? It just doesn't stack up in any way for me. So, no, simply don't buy it.
So do you think they got unlucky with whatever it was that put him out of the race? Or were they just stupid not replacing the gearbox?
Well, it's a call, isn't it? I don't think stupidity, you know, they, I mean, I find it, I mean, I know they said it's got nothing to do with the gearbox, but I think it may have nothing to do with the gearbox, but it is one hell of a coincidence. I mean, I can't remember when a Ferrari or any car failed to turn up on the grid. And the fact that it's the one car that had a big whack and there were all these question marks over it, and it was a drive shaft that failed. I mean, you know, maybe it wasn't, but I don't know. Yeah, I'm sure they looked at it and I'm sure they thought it was fine. I think it was bad luck. And also, I think it was, you know, you think about it, you know, you think about Ferrari, you're a proud, proud team. And you've got pole at Monaco. It's basically, it's the first good news you've had since 2019. Since it all went so horribly, publicly wrong for you. You know, are you, you know, Ferrari starting that race, Ferrari's, what would they would have been, first and fourth? Yeah, so Ferrari's on the first and second rows of the grid. Are you really going to go, let's just give that up? If you can't see any evidence, which doesn't mean there isn't any, but if you can't see any evidence to suggest that the car is damaged, I think you roll the dice. Or I think that's what they did. And I think that as a proud team wanting to be seen to be starting Monaco, which is also, don't forget, pretty much a home Grand Prix for Ferrari, given that you are, what, 3 miles from Italy there? You know, I think that they really, really wanted to see a Ferrari leading a Grand Prix. And I completely understand that.
Yeah. Sadly, the race was over from a sort of spectator point of view. The moment he didn't take the start, wasn't it? It was just quite clear what was going to happen.
I think the moment that Max chopped across the bows of Valtteri, I mean, when it first started, and quite clearly Bottas had a better start, and I was thinking, oh, this could be interesting if they get, you know, if they get up close and personal through Sandoval. But the moment that Max just went, no, not doing that, then, you know, it was going to be down to some mechanical thing. I don't think there was a single overtake in that race. Mick
Schumacher did.
Schumacher,
yeah,
got down in the inside of Mazepin, but he somehow managed to finish behind him.
Oh, did he?
I don't know how he did that. Yeah,
oh, that's interesting.
I don't know how you get beaten by Mazepin, but apparently he did.
Do you know who else predicted a Hamilton pole, Hamilton win before the weekend?
Hamilton.
No. Nick Heidfeld.
Nick Heidfeld.
Because I spoke to him before the weekend for an app only podcast. So it's on the app now. If you subscribe to the app, you can go and listen to Nick Heidfeld now, and he does predict a Hamilton pole and win. So he got that just as wrong as you did.
Good. I mean, but, good company.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting talking to him. He came second there in, I think, 05, and he won the race in an F3 car. He says that the most fun he's had driving around there was in an F3 car.
Yeah, I bet.
Perhaps because it's a bit smaller, a bit more nimble.
Yeah.
And just racier than a
And also, you know, a lot less downforce. You could skid an F3 because you're going to a much smaller car. Which is much less bolt to the ground. You could skid it around there, and that must just be the most fun. Skidding around the streets like that must just be completely brilliant. Having never driven, you know, any single seater around there, never that. I think I understand where he's coming from.
Yeah, yeah. It was good talking to him. Really, it tied into this discussion that we've been having on the podcast and on the app about how you make electric cars fun to drive. And he's a good person to talk to because he loves cars, and I was looking at his Instagram actually, and he's recently bought a Carrera GT, and he describes it as his favourite car ever.
Wow!
So he gets it; he really gets it. He's clearly achieved an enormous amount in racing. In 2007, he drove the BMW F1 car around the Nürburgring, the Nordschleife. So he must be the only person alive who knows what it's like to drive a modern Formula One car around that place. He talks about that in the podcast on the app. But the reason he's a good person to talk to about making electric cars fun to drive is that he is responsible for doing exactly that with the Pininfarina Battista. He is the development driver for that car. And so I just wanted to hear him talk about it. And what struck me is that he sort of shares a frustration that I have, and I know that a lot of other people have, with modern supercars and hypercars that are just so fast. And unless you've got a circuit, you're taking liberties to really tap into their performance and feel them working beneath you. And he understands that. And without me prompting him, he said it. But he insists, nonetheless, that the Pininfarina Battista with its 1900 horsepower is not going to be like that. Which is...
I don't understand it. When you've got a car that is that size, that weight, with that power, how could it be anything else?
So it was really interesting to hear him say that. Let me just play that. I'm just going to play that clip so people can hear.
First time I bought Eimer Rally last year. And this car had, I don't know, maybe 140 horsepower, but it was very light. And that was perfect. Because you feel you're a little bit on the limit and the engine is pulling, but you're nowhere near a dangerous speed or near to an illegal speed. So this was for me very clearly, therefore, the target to build a car that doesn't make you do crazy things.
So you're quite right to question it. It remains to be seen how on earth it's possible for something that weighs 2 tons, has 1,900 horsepower, to not be one of these frustrating hypercars that you just can't explore on the road. He insists that will be the case. I don't know. We're going to have to wait until we have a go in that thing, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
While we're here, we should mention that as of today, the Intercooler app is 4 weeks old. That's gone by quickly, hasn't it?
Our 1 month anniversary is this week.
It is this week. Let's just reflect on the first month. Thousands and thousands of you have downloaded the app. Lots of you have subscribed and you're contributing in the comments and you're getting stuck in and you're giving us feedback. It's all been really encouraging, really positive so far. There have been a few little niggles. There will be improvements made to the app very soon, quite substantial improvements, and we'll be telling people about those in the next couple of weeks or so. I don't know. People seem to be enjoying it.
Well, I just take great heart from... the numbers speak for themselves, but I also take great heart from the fact that we've had... It's the thick end of... It's 400... It's nearly 500 ratings and reviews on the Apple and Google App Stores. And at the moment, we're averaging 5.0, which is as good as you can get. You can't do better than that. And there are so many comments, and so many people have been kind enough to sit down and tell us what they think about what we're doing. I just find it really encouraging. And it breeds confidence for us to think that actually having this very unusual and slightly mad idea of creating an ad-free environment where the best writers write the best things that they can, and we provide it to our subscribers in the most convenient form possible, there might be something in it. And certainly all the numbers, both objectively and subjectively, I guess, all the evidence suggests so far that that it does. But it's still extremely early days. So do go take a look. It's incredibly easy to download. It's even easier to cancel if you don't like it. You can just go into your settings and get rid of it. It really couldn't be easier. If you do already, or if you look at it and you discover you do like it, please tell people, because the more that that happens, the more that we can do all the other things that we want to be doing, particularly with video and guest podcasts and that sort of thing. It just makes our life a lot... The quicker we can spread the word, the faster we can... turn it into absolutely what we want it to be. It's pretty good now. We hope and we think, and the comments suggest, but it can get even better. And we're just excited to get on that job. So yeah, anything you could do for us in that regard would be great.
Yeah, tell your friends, tweet about it, post about it on Instagram if you like. We'd appreciate all of that. It would really help. We're trying to be very transparent with how you cancel. If you take out a subscription or you start the free trial, everyone gets offered a 1 month free trial. If it's not for you, just cancel. You can cancel very easily.
You don't have to ring anybody up or anything.
No. And you do that in the settings app on your phone, not within the TI app itself. It's in the sort of native settings app on your phone. There'll be, whether you're Google or Apple, there'll be a subscriptions button, and you'll go in there and you can cancel. It's really easy, so you might as well take out a free trial, but we think you'll stick with us because, well, it's pretty good. And we've got we'll announce a new writer very soon. We're quite excited about this new writer of ours, and we will be making substantial improvements to the comments system, the comments function, and will enable you to read on a desktop or a laptop computer as well. So just making it even better, even more convenient. And we'll just improve this thing as we go. Promo over, or is there anything else to say?
No, I think that's it. I think it's more than us blathering on about how brilliant we are. No, that's fine.
Okay, motor racing dynasties, keeping dynasties. It in the family.
Yes.
So can you really not read your notes, or are we flying blind here?
No, we're flying blind.
Okay. Well, fine. I mean, it's an interesting topic because I've been thinking about it a lot, and actually the children of racing parents are massively overrepresented in motorsport compared to the general population. The vast majority of us clearly don't have racing parents, but a good proportion of the sort of familiar names in the top categories of motorsport have racing parents. So there's something in it. And just to get us started, I want to know from you if you think it's to do with wealth, resource, experience, contacts, know-how, or if there's something that's passed down genetically.
It's all of the above, isn't it? It's the nature and it's the nurture. It has to be. I mean, the genetic thing is that they have to want to do it. There are all sorts of people who are the sons of amazing, for instance, Elliot Moss, Sterling's son, lovely bloke, no interested in racing at all.
Oh, really?
No, not at all. And so you have to, you absolutely have to want to do it. And I think that obviously, having a name helps. But I think that an awful lot of people who do it find that name as much of a curse as a benefit, because it's always, oh, well, you got into that car only because, dad's who he is and that sort of thing. And I think that there's a great desire, isn't there, to prove yourself beyond the family environment. And the way I look at it is, with all things in life, if someone is able to open a door for you, that is one thing, but it's actually what you do when you've got through that door and are on the other side that really matters. Do you have a view as to whether children tend to be better or worse than their dads? I mean, my view, and I don't have necessarily the empirical evidence, not least because I can't read my own handwriting, and I think that fathers tend to be better than sons. So I think there is a bit of gene dilution going on. Now, I know that there are exceptions to it. But I think generally as a rule, I think the offspring, I mean, if you look at, the Brabham family, there was Jack, three times world champion, absolute, the first person to win the only person to win a world championship in a car of his own creation. And then there are the sons. There was Jeff, there was Gary, and there's David, all exceptional drivers, all of whom did amazing stuff. I mean, David and Jeff both won Le Mans. But I don't think even they would say for a moment that they were in the same street as their dad.
Mm. That's really interesting.
Graham and Damon. Damon, Formula One world champion. Graham, double Formula One world champion, winner of the Indy 500, winner of Le Mans, only person in history ever to have done that.
Mm. Yeah, it's a good point. Also, I know the statistics don't back this up, but Gilles and Jacques?
Gilles and Jacques. It depends which Jacques you're talking about. Are you talking about Jacques the son or Jacques the uncle?
I'm talking about the 97 F1 world champion.
Ah, okay, that Jacques, yes.
There's another one.
Yeah, there's another Jacques Villeneuve. Who was an absolute dude. Uncle Jacques. He did do a few Formula One races, and he was a Can-Am champion. His big thing was snowmobile. On a snowmobile, he was just like, forget it, don't even turn up if you're not Uncle Jack, because he was just an absolute ace on those things, and he's still around. So Gilles, and Jacques, well, for me, Gilles is in a totally different category to his, and I think had he lived, he would have shown that. And frankly, had he not been such an amazing team player, had he not just sat behind Jody throughout the entire 1979 season, and just played the number two, because that's what he was, and he was there for the team. I mean, I've likened him to Gilles to Sterling, insofar as I think they're the only two people to have had that extraordinary, ferocious talent, and yet who have also been completely prepared to be a number two in the way Stirling was to Fangio in 1955. He was just, he sat behind and learned from the master. And I think that Villeneuve was extraordinary in his character, Gilles Villeneuve, to have done that. And I don't frankly think that Jacques Villeneuve is, whatever the statistics say, I don't think that he is in the same street, in the same league, anywhere near his dad.
I think you have a point. Probably the statistics would back that up, wouldn't it? That there is some gene dilution from father to offspring, because there are fewer examples of the opposite. I mean, there's a certain Monaco Grand Prix winner. Yesterday, actually, he became a Monaco Grand Prix winner, who would be recognised as a better racer than his father.
Absolutely.
Max Verstappen. I mean, his talent is just enormous. And Jos Verstappen is clearly a good driver, but not to the same degree.
No. So there are definitely exceptions. Okay, another question I was going to ask you. What's a dynasty?
Well, right, okay. At which point does it become a dynasty?
Yeah, so if it's just like a father and a son, and I'm sorry not to mention any women in this, but there just haven't been any examples because, you know, there haven't been enough women in at the top level in motorsport to be able to make these kind of conclusions. But I think you need a family. I think you need a Brabham or an Unser or an Andretti or a Fittipaldi. Yeah. I think you need a whole sprawling family before you can say that's a dynasty, because otherwise it's just, you know, it's just dad and his kid, isn't it?
Okay, well, that's a good point. And you've addressed something that I was going to bring up. We seem to have more of these big sprawling dynasties in the US.
Yes, but, okay, we think of the Unsers and the Fittipaldis and we think of the Andrettis, but the Fittipaldis were Brazilian. The Andrettis are Italian, naturalised in America, but Mario was born in Italy. Didn't speak, you know, English is his second language. But then there is the example of the Unsers. No, but actually, no, because the Unsers are Swiss, aren't they?
Are they?
Yes.
Well, okay, but they've raced in America.
So they're not American. They just go to America, and then they do all their stuff in America. But yes, no, you absolutely do have a point. Yes, there's an awful lot more of it going on over there than over here.
I wonder if, why is that then? I wonder if there's a bit more nepotism in US racing, or if maybe it's marketing led. Maybe your surname is just worth so much more out there. If you are an Andretti, you'll get in a well funded seat, maybe.
Yeah, but you still have to be able to do it, don't you?
You do. It would be unfair to suggest otherwise. We're seeing it in rallying now. Okay, maybe these aren't dynasties as such because it's only father and son, but. It's really interesting to watch a couple of the sons of some stars of the WRC in the 90s and the 2000s coming through, notably Oliver Solberg, who just looks like an enormous talent, and Kalle Rovanperä, who after, I think it was the first two rounds of this year's championship, was leading the title fight. He's not anymore, but I mean, that's quite good, isn't it? And he's clearly...
quite good, yeah.
Harry Rovanperä's son, he's clearly a brilliant driver. What's amazing about these young kids, and they are kids really, Oliver Solberg and Kalle Rovanperä, is that they're so fast. In rallying in particular, it used to be the case for a long time that not until you were 25 did you have the experience to run at WRC pace. But these guys are 19, 20, 21, and they're there. They're really flying. I think it's extraordinary to see. I remember I was on the Monte Carlo rally in, I don't know, maybe it's 15 years ago or something, 14 years ago, when Petter was still a works Subaru driver. I was with ProDrive, the Subaru team, and we were down in Monaco for the super special, the spectator stage, and there's this young blonde-haired kid running around. He must have been 4 or 5. And that was Oliver Solberg. And now he's probably the brightest young rally driving talent that there is. It was in 2019 that he did a year in the American Rally Championship with Subaru. And so he was teammates to David Higgins and Craig Drew. And Craig is a mate of mine. And he was saying that Oliver is massively fast, but... in rallying, you have to know when to be fast, because if the conditions are rough or if the car, you know, has got an issue or something, if you're just fast the whole time, you will break it or you'll get punctures. And that is not the way to win championships.
So that's just experience, isn't it? That's just something you've got to learn. talent won't get you that. You've got to learn it.
It takes that bit of control, doesn't it? And that's what you learn when you're young. And he will, I'm sure. Yeah. Some of the stage times that he sets, Oliver Solberg, there's just no doubt that he's got the speed. And I mean, that it brings up the nature nurture thing for me as well, because there's no question that he was driving these cars, or, you know, he was driving rally cars from a very, very young age. Kelly Rovanperä as well. There's some footage of him out there when he's really just a kid, maybe 10, 11 years old, driving a rally car, effectively with a booster seat, and he's going really quickly. So I think if you get that opportunity from a really young age to figure out what rally driving is all about, then it's a compounding interest, isn't it? And for the rest of your career, you have an advantage, you have an edge over someone else your age who started much later. These kids are going to come through, and they're going to light up the championship in the next few years. And it probably means that the established names at the moment are going to find themselves with some real competition. It's going to be great.
Talking of kids, do you think that however many races we are into the season, do you think that even though he's probably in the slowest car, that Mick Schumacher would have made more of an impact than he has if he were absolutely a chip off the old block?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think he won the F2 title, but he won it through consistency, didn't he? I don't think he got a pole, and he didn't win tons of races. So he won the championship. That's really all that matters. But is it even possible to demonstrate a raw talent in a car like this year's Haas? I mean, there will be opportunities. We've seen some do it in the past, but all you can do really is beat your teammate in qualifying and beat them in the races. And
but I suspect that beating Mazepin in qualifying isn't necessarily the toughest job in Formula One.
It's probably not, but
all he can do, isn't it?
Yeah. And if he's beating him by half a second or something, it's fairly emphatic, isn't it? But really, for us to know how good Mick Schumacher is he a Michael? Is he a Ralph? He's gonna need a shot in a more competitive car.
Yeah. Well, hopefully Haas will be able to provide him with one of those, because I mean, they've said, haven't they, that basically they're just writing off this year, and they're pouring everything into next year's car. So we will see. So my question to you is, I don't think we can exit this podcast. I'm aware that we're running out of time, but I don't think without naming the greatest motor racing dynasty. And I think it is down to the Fittipaldis, the Andrettis and the Unsers, because I think just in terms of the number of people that are involved in that. I mean, you know, Fittipaldi, there was Wilson, there was Emerson, there's Christian, and there's Pietro, who did a race last year in Formula One. Christian did, I can read some of my writing, 43 Grand Prix, one Daytona three times, Sebring twice. Wilson, you know, Emo's brother, did 38 Grand Prix. I think he got three podiums. And then, of course, there's Emerson. You know, the youngest ever world champion, 1972, when he got it. Obviously, that's been beaten by others since. 14 wins, two Indy 500s. So that's the Fittipaldis. The Andrettis, well, there's Michael who did, I think Michael won 42 IndyCar races. And obviously he had that not very successful time in Formula One in the McLaren. And there's Marco Andretti, who's doing, you know, great stuff, a couple of wins. And then there's Mario, who's just the consummate. I mean, he is the consummate racing driver. He's won the Formula One World Championship. He's won the Indy 500. But actually, to me, it's the Unsers. Okay, now get this. Okay, between them, the Unsers have won the Indy 500 nine times, which is, according to my notes, which I can just about read here. So that's Big Al Senior 4, Bobby 3, and Little Al 2. 9 Indy 500s, and then endless wins in other other areas of racing over there. And there were so many of them. There was Joe, and there was Louis, and there was Jerry, and there was Al Senior, and Al Junior, and there was Bobby, and there was Robbie, and there's, you know, they're just basically Unsers everywhere.
Everywhere.
And they all do really, really well. So I think although almost all of what they achieved was done over there rather than over here, I still think that is a record, a dynastic record, which I think you're going to struggle to beat.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to argue with that. That is impressive. So we're declaring
Indy 500 wins in one family.
We're declaring that Unser's the greatest motor racing dynasty of all time.
Yes. Well, I am.
Well, okay.
I hope people get on here and tell me I'm wrong and why it's not the tiddlywood pushes from wherever. But yeah, to me they are.
Good. Okay. Well, let's leave that one there. That was fun. What do I want you all to do this week? Just go and download the app and start your free trial if you haven't already. Just search the Intercooler on either App Store, whichever App Store you use, and you'll find it straight away. Download it, start your free trial. If you don't like it, cancel it in the Settings app on your phone. Simple. And we'll keep bringing you some of the best writing from some of the best writers out there today, because we've been doing it for 4 weeks. We're not going to stop, and it's just going to get better and better and better. Yeah, come back next week for another podcast.
Look forward to it. Thanks all.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.